Coming up, a Muslim school or a madrasa. Fred DeSam Lazaro reports from Pakistan on one madrasa trying to give its students not only a religious education, but against strong opposition, a broad general education as well. Also, singing in a choir. Volunteers in the Choral Society at New York's Grace Church tell Bob Faw all the things choral singing does for them. And Muslims around the world marking the end of Ramadan with Eid al-Fitr.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. U.S. Muslims were among those condemning the shootings at two military installations in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that killed four Marines and wounded several others, prompting a federal domestic terrorism investigation. The deceased gunman was identified as a 24-year-old Kuwaiti-born man. The Muslim Public Affairs Council called the attacks cowardly and despicable. Religious groups had wide-ranging reactions to this week's historic deal to severely restrict Iran's nuclear program in exchange for lifting economic sanctions. The accord was reached after months of negotiation between Iran and a group of six countries led by the U.S. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was sharply critical, charging that too many concessions had been made to Iran, which would threaten Israel's security. Several Jewish groups echoed his concerns, but other religious groups, including the Vatican, praised the deal as a step toward peace. This week, President Obama continued his push to reform America's criminal justice system. In Oklahoma, he toured the El Reno Corrections Facility, becoming the first sitting U.S. president to visit a federal prison. In an address to the NAACP convention in Philadelphia, he spoke out against excessive punishments for nonviolent crimes, particularly the use of mandatory minimum sentences. He alluded to the teachings of Christianity, saying, quote, "Justice and redemption go hand in hand." Now that Pope Francis has finished his week-long visit to South America, he says he'll be preparing for his September visit to the U.S., and he says that will include reading up on criticisms of some of his recent statements about global economic policy. Francis has repeatedly raised concerns about greed and capitalism. In Paraguay last weekend, he urged politicians and business leaders not to support economic agendas which, quote, "sacrifice human lives on the altar of money and profit." Some U.S. critics have called such statements flawed. Francis says he hopes to have a dialogue with those critics. Planned Parenthood is facing several official investigations following the release of a secretly taped video that shows one of its executives discussing how the group provides medical researchers with the organs of aborted fetuses. The video was made public by the anti-abortion group Center for Medical Progress, which called it proof that Planned Parenthood profits from the illegal sale of fetal tissue. Planned Parenthood said the video misrepresented its work. It insisted there's no financial benefit to donating fetal tissue for research and that it has the consent of patients. The video has prompted an outcry from many Catholics and evangelicals. Church-state activists are urging the U.S. Supreme Court to take up the issue of whether faith-based nonprofits must provide contraception coverage under the Affordable Care Act. This week, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that a group of nuns, the Little Sisters of the Poor, must provide the coverage to employees or face IRS penalties. The nuns say providing the coverage would violate their religious beliefs, even if it's done through a third party, as the administration proposes. Several other religious groups also have lawsuits underway. As people in the West try to understand violent, radical interpretations of Islam, they often say what's needed in Muslim countries is general education for boys and girls. Once family-operated, largely religious schools, madrasas, taught students not only Arabic and the Quran, but secular subjects too. Then many madrasas were politicized and radicalized and became breeding grounds for violent extremism. Fred DeSam Lazaro recently visited a madrasa in predominantly Muslim Pakistan that's trying to get back to providing a general education.
The Jamia Islamia Clifton Madrasa was founded 40 years ago by Mufti Abu Huraira's father, building, he says, on a tradition that goes back 1,400 years.
Madrasas were established and came about right at the onset of Islam. The Prophet established the madrasa, and they have played a very significant role in the spread of Islam.
Madrasas have long had a large footprint in Islamic societies, says University of Minnesota anthropologist William Beeman.
From medieval time down to almost the current modern period, the madrasa in Islamic society was the principal source of education for young people. And they would learn Arabic, of course, in order to be able to read the Quran and say their prayers. But they would also be instructed in mathematics or in literature. In Iran, they might be instructed in traditional classic poetry. That's true also in the Arab world.
It was also true in India, ruled for centuries by the Muslim Mughal Empire. But during the British rule that followed, madrasas retreated to a narrower Quran-based curriculum, and by the late 1800s, Beeman says, they started to become politicized as they joined the opposition to British rule.
In protests, in demonstrations, it fed right in the 20th century to the resistance movement that was led by Gandhi, who's, of course, not Muslim, but this was a unified movement from the Hindu population of the subcontinent and the Islamic population of the subcontinent. And, of course, we know that at the time of liberation of the subcontinent, then there was a split between the Muslim populations and the Hindu populations.
The Islamic Republic of Pakistan, created from the partition of India at independence, would be dogged by conflict for decades to follow. Directly with India and indirectly from neighboring Afghanistan. Some madrasas became embroiled in the turmoil, far removed from the original mission, says Abu Huraira.
The role of the madrasa is for the spread of education, to bring about betterment in a person's morals and a society that is harmonious and peaceful. And one of the first people to raise a voice openly against the deviation from the purely educational aspects was my father.
But some madrasas became not just politicized, but radicalized. And experts say they proliferated. By some estimates, there are as many as 22,000 across Pakistan today, due to many factors. The madrasa was an alternative to a failing, even absent public school. And poverty. Madrasas provide free food and shelter. Though the curriculum, in many cases just rote memorization of Islam's holy book, gave graduates few job skills, says Beeman.
They'd even memorize sometimes the whole Quran and not really understand a single sentence of what they were, of what they had learned. And so it was very easy for people to be influenced by interpretations, by extremist interpretations of Quranic verse.
Those came primarily from militant Salafism, a conservative Islam prevalent in Saudi Arabia and the Arab Gulf states. Its missionaries were veterans from the Afghan conflict.
They really set up shop in what they thought was an area that was going to be fertile for their kind of message. The rather traditional madrasas became radicalized through the Salafi movement. And new madrasas sprung up, which also indoctrinated young people in this rather violent movement in Islam and the resistance that they had advocated against the West, and against other Muslims who didn't agree with them.
At Jamia Islamia, Mufti Abu Huraira says students are vetted for any history of or ties to extremist activity. Discussions of politics or sectarianism are forbidden. The Quran remains at the core of the curriculum for all 1,500 students, spread across 6 campuses, including 2 exclusively female ones. We asked, but were not permitted to film there during our visit.
The first thing in the morning, we learn the Quran Sharif. Then after that, we learn the regular school subjects, like math and English and computers. And then in the afternoon, we are taught how to behave with parents and other members in society, and how to treat children and old people. Basically, the code of a good life.
Madrasa leaders say a big part of that is tolerance, critical in a land that regularly sees violence among Islamic sects and church burnings. About 2% of Pakistanis are Christian. Officials here say enrollment is open to all Islamic sects, though the founders and most students are from the Deobandi branch of Sunni Islam.
Here we are taught, and Islam teaches us, not to abuse and say bad things about people of different religions. You must respect them. You must respect their places of worship. They have as much of a right for protection as a mosque would have.
The madrasa leaders say their alums have gone on not just into clerical, but also secular occupations, one reason why students are taught English in addition to Arabic.
They are providing us about the knowledge of computer, they are providing us the knowledge of English language, they are providing the knowledge of journalism, they are providing the knowledge of philosophy and many other things.
Jamia Islamia says it is funded entirely by the tithes required of all Muslims. But even as it boasts strong support among Pakistan's faithful, there is sectarian unrest as well, and that presents a constant threat.
We have a lot of friends who do not like our work. There is so much opposition to what we are pursuing at Jamia Islamia on a daily basis. There are threats to my life, I know that. There's threat to whatever we do here at Jamia Islamia. But for me, it is a mission.
A mission to bring an institution into the modern world by taking it back to its ancient traditions that went well beyond the Holy Book. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Karachi, Pakistan.
Now, the many benefits of choral singing. Volunteers in the Choral Society at New York's Grace Church tell Bob Thaw that choral singing overcomes hardship, feeds the soul, creates community, serves as a workout, shrinks the ego, and just plain makes everyone happy.
As the glorious sound reverberates through this mini-cathedral, New York City's Grace Church, these singers know there is more happening here than the artful blending of voices and composition. Just ask Stacy Horn, who says, "When I'm singing, I become suspended in a world where everything bad is bearable and everything good is possible."
It just somehow manages to do whatever you need it to do. At terrible times, when you need it most, choral singing just gives you a way out, just somehow gives you a way to transcend whatever you must endure and find peace.
Attorney John McClay, who directs this 150-voice choir of volunteers, says singing like this is deeply satisfying.
It really is something that answers a deep-seated need in the soul to be part of something that's greater than what you individually can achieve. You both sort of lose yourself and find yourself at the same time. In this type of an activity, you are actually using your body to breathe life into the composer's creation. And that kind of organic experience, I think, really feeds your soul in a way that your daily life really can't.
Sanctus, Sanctus.
At home, Stacy practices almost every day.
Sanctus,
The vocal drills pay off in rehearsal every Tuesday night, where Stacy's been showing up faithfully since 1982.
Choir rehearsal is a place where you go to heal. It never fails to make me feel better. So in terrible times, I'm not going to avoid it. I'm going to run to it.
Here, where McClay gently cracks the choral whip.
Good. And stop. Good. I feel like you're thinking too hard.
Okay. Coaxing, cajoling, complimenting, always getting the best out of his singers.
One, two, three.
We do a lot of in rehearsal is that sort of balancing act between the voice types and, frankly, between the different personalities in the group. And it all sort of creating that unity out of diversity, I think, is the task of making music.
The pieces that we sing are works of art. They're masterpieces. And our voices, our bodies are the instruments that convey those masterpieces. So when I sing, and this is literally, not figuratively, that resonance is moving through my body, head to toe.
What is happening here is more than musical. As they sing, their bodies are literally changed, with the brain producing endorphins, which increase pleasure and decrease stress and anxiety. It is engaging and relaxing, says choir member Darren Walker.
But there's a meditative element to it, and the fact that you are giving and you have responsibility to be somebody who's contributing a specific line to this group activity, it really focuses you. So that brings about some relaxation.
And, says soprano Nicole Belmont, it doesn't just figuratively change how you feel.
When one performs, it really feels like a workout. Afterwards, it's a big exhale. But it really does feel like a workout.
In order to have an engaged sound, it requires a lot of the body. It's not a passive experience at all, for soft singing especially, but even for loud singing. Yeah, that is, in essence, a controlled scream, a beautiful one, but nevertheless, you're unleashing everything from within.
In her book, Imperfect Harmony, Horn describes all the joys of group singing, which Belmont finds are both physical and mental.
The thing that I was not expecting was discipline and the accountability you have on yourself to make yourself ready to come to rehearsal and not let the other people down.
And there's another big benefit in singing in a group like this, namely the group itself.
You can't sing a masterpiece like the Brahms Requiem alone. You have to learn how to put your ego aside and work together with all the voices around you in utter, complete, and equal cooperation. Once you've experienced the bliss that comes from that kind of cooperation, you are highly motivated to continue.
To me, the choir is really a microcosm of what a community ought to be. People are not worried about sort of status within their social position or their family hierarchy. What they are worried about is all together singing D major.
You really get to appreciate people from completely different backgrounds. I've definitely found just 3 years in, I'm a different person. I'm much more thoughtful, much more aware of other people, much more respectful of other people. You know, so it's quite profound.
While this choral society attempts to master and perform only the most difficult choral works, many of them sacred, choir members are not necessarily religious.
I can't help but feel grateful that religion has inspired and nurtured these works of art that have had such a profound effect on my life, regardless of what I believe. The fact that people, regardless of their beliefs, can be comforted by this music, it makes religion in this form a great ambassador. It brings people together rather than pulling them apart.
I think it provides a spiritual need, especially for those who don't necessarily go to services on a regular basis. Yeah, and I think that's a very important thing to have, something where you're able to think about forces in life that are greater than you.
Can you find happiness only when singing in a group? No, says McClay, but it certainly makes it more meaningful.
The simple quality of singing a folk song or singing a song that you've heard on the radio, it does that job of kind of releasing the endorphins and making you feel happy. What I think choral singing does on top of that is to add the layer of being the co-creative of a masterpiece and actually serving the other people that you're singing with as well as you're serving the music.
Ultimately, all the hard work, the discipline and sense of community come together in one magnificent sound. When the individual benefits are multiplied, and why some call group singing the perfect drug, cheaper than therapy, healthier than drinking, and more fun than working out. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in New York.
On our calendar, Hindus in Western India have kicked off a festival that happens once every 12 years. Over the next several weeks, millions of pilgrims are expected to bathe in the Godavari River during the Kumbh Mela, or Pitcher Festival. Hindu tradition says bathing in the sacred river will cleanse their sins. And Muslims around the world are observing Eid al-Fitr, the three-day festival marking the end of Ramadan. During the holy month of Ramadan, Muslims who were able fasted from sunrise to sunset. Imam Johari Abdul Malik of the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, describes the transition from Ramadan to the Eid.
You know, when we think about a month that is starving the body, but then you have to figure out, how do you feed your soul? The process of withdrawing from the things that really drive you causes you, in a sense, to feel, I have to rely on God for my energy. Something that you really can't prepare for is the feeling that you will miss Ramadan when it's over. You will spend time reminiscing, trying to prepare yourself not to have remorse, not to say, I let Ramadan slip through my fingers. I really could have prayed more. I could have done more charity. And so I encourage people, prepare yourself so that when the month ends, you don't have remorse, that you did what you could do, and then be grateful. Saturday and Sunday will be days of fun and play, especially for children. So we'll have moon bounce, we'll have rides. It's a day of fun, it's a day of joy, and it's summertime. And so in the summertime, we celebrate like that. On the day of Eid al-Fitr, every family will donate to provide for a family of their size. It's called Zakat al-Fitr. I have to duplicate my joy for that day and share it with others so that it really is a day that everyone in the community should have. It's going to be an opportunity to enjoy a light but quick breakfast and then to come to the mosque to listen to a short sermon with two units of prayer. And in that sermon, it is going to be a reminder about the great success that we have made as humanity. We have all come out of it with a renewed spirit and a renewed conviction. And so it is about celebration. It is about people congratulating one another that we survived the month of Ramadan.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more music from the Choral Society at New York's Grace Church.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.